Welcome to Cooper Talk. I'm your host, Steve Cooper. And remember, I'm only as hip as my guest. And I got to tell you, I'm going back east tomorrow, and I'm looking forward to it. But I'm getting a little bummed out, because whenever I go back east, it seems like it's always cloudy or it's raining in the forecast. And my girlfriend tried to tell me the reason that's it is because it's always hot and humid. They don't know what's going to happen. So it's just a little confusing. I mean, I thought if that's the reason, I mean, I know LA weather people had it easy because they just say it's sunny all the time. But I guess there they just put rain. So hopefully it won't rain. And I just want to say, when you're listening to this, I'll actually be on a flight. I'll be about landing. I'll be landing in Philly straight from O'Hare. Anyway, we have a great show. We have a very funny guy, Frank Conniff. How you doing, Frank?
Hey, hi.
As I told him, Chris Mancini was on a few weeks ago. Mm-hmm. Frank had used to book a comedy show. But how did you, just before we'll talk about it, but mm-hmm. how did you find, it's so weird, like a Borders.
That was in the 90s in L.A., and it seemed like every retail outlet was doing comedy.
Okay.
There was a kind of, I guess, part of the alternative comedy movement. There was comedy in art galleries, in coffee shops, and in a few bookstores. There was a place called L.A., the bookstore, I remember, in Santa Monica that had really good lineup. That was the first time I ever saw Kathy Griffin was there. And then Borders in a few places, I think, had comedy. And we did it on La Cienega. And we started doing it. And it went on for years and years. And it was pretty hilarious because a lot of times there were just people there studying and they didn't care about the show and they didn't pay attention to it. I started saying that, people came to our show just because it was a great place to study. There was no distractions like laughter or anything like that. You could just have a relaxing setting where you could study your books. But it was actually probably the highest paying gig in the alternative comedy market in L.A., yes, because most alternative comedy gigs paid nothing. And in this gig, you got a $30 gift certificate for a book.
I think I got it. Yeah. Weird. It's like, take this.
And the comics were always thrilled about that, And so we'd always hang out after the show and people would be browsing for books that they were going to buy with their gift certificate.
How was the first? I mean, I'm sure you're in the show. How would you pitch it? To comics, like, hey, I guess because the alternative thing was, but it's like when you're a comic, I got this gig for you, and you're like, okay, and it's like, instead of Borders, what was the reaction there?
There was no kind of surprised reaction because, like I said, people, at least in the circles that Chris and I ran in, everyone was doing comedy in kind of alternative spaces.
Who were some of those comics? Do you remember?
Yeah.
Was it Tompkins? Was Tompkins
there?
Paul
F. Tompkins was there. Andy Kindler, Patton Oswalt.
Okay.
Kathy Griffin, Bob Odenkirk. Janine Garofalo. Greg Barrett, Blaine Capatch, just everyone who's still funny now.
It just must be amazing. Somewhere there's some idiot who's sitting there going, God, I could have seen this amazing comedy show, but I was studying instead.
That's still the case in L.A., I must say, that if you really research it and look around, you can see really great shows for very little money or no money.
I've heard that Meltdown Comics gets really great
shows.
Yeah,
Meltdown has great. The Fake Gallery. I went to the Fake Gallery a couple weeks ago. It was
the Fake Gallery. Is that Paul?
It's on Melrose.
Is that Paul Kozlowski?
Paul Kozlowski,
because I know
yes.
Toby Huss was on the show a while ago, and I think he had talked about that.
Yeah, Toby Huss, had his own art gallery around the corner from there. But I went there a few weeks ago, and Eddie Pepitone and I used to do a show there, and I went there a couple weeks ago, and it was Eddie and Dana Gould and Todd Glass, three of the greatest comics working in this little space.
That's what's cool.
Yeah, that you can, and people could, I think it was $5 or $10 or something.
See, it's so funny because you can go to other clubs, even like when I go back east, sometimes cause my girlfriend lives back there, I'll perform and I'll feature, and I'll go back and just because I like to do it, I don't do it all the time, but I like to, help pay for the flight, just have some fun.
Right.
But even like the price is there, and it's like you're seeing acts who are in the Philly area, 20 years ago. It's not, but it's $20, $2 minimum. And that's what's amazing about LA is, I went to a show and they're not big names. They're huge names, but I was doing a show at the Ha Ha Cafe and it was free to get in before 8.
Right.
And then who comes in to do guest sets? what's his name? Damon Wayans Jr., oh, okay. Sean Wayans, and Chris Tucker. So these people paid nothing. And
that's right.
Like, it's just weird. Like in these shows, $5, I mean, Ty Glass is a fellow Philly guy. Eddie's been on the show. Dana Gould's brilliant. Mm-hmm. It's cool what people can really get.
Yeah, you can really. And I must say, that, you know, I've been in L.A. for a while, but the comedy scene in L.A. right now is as good as it's ever been since I've been here. You know, and it was pretty great when I first got here. But there's a lot of the newer, the kids, as I would say, coming up, there's a lot of really talented, really funny people, and people are really devoted to the art and craft of stand-up comedy. You know, there are really a lot of people in L.A. right now really working hard on it.
Okay, where are you from originally?
I'm from New York City.
Okay, now did you know as a young kid, because I talk about this with guests, we always talk about how you wanted to do comedy. Like me, one of the influences, my brother used to listen to Cheech and Chong and Wedding Album.
Right.
And I used to, my dad used to watch, you know, the late night Carson and Woody Allen on PBS.
Right.
So I got a feel. What was some of the things that exposed you to comedy or made you sit there and go, God, I want to do that? Do you remember anything?
Yeah, sure. I mean, you know, watching the Ed Sullivan Show, and, you know, there were a lot of variety shows on TV back then. And there were always comedians on it. And, you know, as a kid, I was pretty well-versed in who the comedians were who were on TV a lot. I remember George Carlin, before he became a counterculture comedian, when he was just a straight arrow, regular comic in the early 60s on the Ed Sullivan Show, the Mike Douglas Show, the Merv Griffin Show, he was hilarious. I loved him back then. He was hilarious in that incarnation, too. And I remember Woody Allen had a gigantic impact on me, and Jonathan Winters and Bob Newhart and Don Rickles. I mean, you know, I was always, anytime there was comedians on television back then, I was always checking it out. And I was, I don't think I was allowed to stay up late to watch The Tonight Show, but I think I did a lot.
Yeah.
Because I saw a lot of, I was very enamored of that whole world, you know. So, you know, I know a lot of comics who said, oh, I never thought about doing comedy till I was an adult, and I was at a club, and on a dare I got up on stage. You know,
right, you're like,
I'm like a guy who was very interested in it for as long as I can remember. When I was 7 years old, I would tell people with great authority that It's a Mad, 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 Mad World was the funniest film ever made. I've since revised my opinion. But when I was seven, I wouldn't hear anything but that it was the funniest movie ever.
But that's cool, though. How, you know, it's good to have an opinion like that. And it's good that you got to see comedy and you appreciate it.
And when I was like six, I was a big Jerry Lewis fan. You know, I just was into it right from the start.
So what? Okay, so you knew you wanted to do it. Well, did you know which way you're going to go from that? I mean, when did you say I'm going to? What did it in your mind? You're going to write or perform? Or
wanted to do both. I mean, originally, actually, I think. My initial instinct, because I was very shy and I didn't know if I had what it took to be a performer.
Right.
But my initial instinct was to become a TV comedy writer. That was kind of my ambition. You know, like all comedy writers say, you know, watching the Dick Van Dyke Show and, you know, had a big influence on me. So that was my initial instinct, but I didn't really know how to break into that. And I, you know, I knew there was a lot of comedy going on, and I even though I was reluctant because I was just afraid of it.
You're in New York City,
yeah,
right?
I was in
so
New
you're,
York
you're
City.
Around the, yeah. the epicenter somewhat.
Yeah, exactly. But I was still determined to do it. So, but it was a slow process at first because, like I said, I had a lot of fear, and I didn't really, I wasn't one of these people who knew exactly who he was as a comedian from the moment he started.
Right.
You know, it took me a while to figure out the kind of comedy I wanted to do and to find my voice, as it were, as a comedian. And then I also, it was the early 80s in New York, and I had substance abuse problems, and that screwed everything up in my life. But then by 85, I went to drug rehab in Minneapolis, and I cleaned up, and then in Minneapolis I really started seriously, consistently working at becoming a stand-up.
Well, I heard there was a very hip comic scene in Minneapolis.
Yeah, in the 80s. I was just pure luck and pure fortune that just fell upon me once I moved to Minneapolis.
So you moved after you went. You left New York.
Just to go to treatment.
Okay.
And then, that's what the travel agent told me. No. And then when I was there, I was like, why go back to New York? That's where I got into all kinds of trouble.
Right.
And so I stayed in Minneapolis at first, just because there was a great recovery community there, and that was very important to me. But then there, then I saw there was this great comedy scene, and there was actually a club called the Ha Ha Club in Minneapolis that was a non-alcoholic place. And so that was kind of like a perfect place for me to go and do it at first. And then the Comedy Gallery was the comedy club kind of place with alcohol and everything. And it took me a few months, and then I finally decided I just got to give it a shot.
Yeah, because most clubs are going to have alcohol.
Yeah,
it's not facing your demons, but it's like, I want to do this.
Yeah, and then it wasn't a problem. I once I got there, and the people at the Comedy Gallery were very welcoming to me. My first open mic there, Paul Dillery, who became a good friend of mine.
Wasn't Cesario up there too?
Yes. Well, Cesario had moved to L. He started doing comedy there, but he was already in L. A.
Because I always thought he was a New York guy. He was on the show, and he said, "No, he's basically
he's from Wisconsin."
Which is crazy. And now Jackie Cation, she's from Wisconsin too, right?
I actually saw Jackie Cation, and I'm very proud of this, and I always talk about it when I see her and stuff, because she's a good friend of mine. But I'm very proud of the fact that Jackie Cation performed at an open mic in Minneapolis at the top of the IDS building called Cleo's, I think was the name of the place, that had an open mic on Sunday nights. She was in school in Wisconsin. She was just coming. She was just in Minneapolis. And I saw her do stand-up, and I told her, wow, you're really funny. And then she went back to school, and then she came back and then seriously started doing comedy. But I was just very aware of her talent right from the moment, almost the moment she started doing comedy.
Isn't that cool?
I'm very proud of that.
And now you're friends, and it's so how it goes full circle.
The same thing with Maria Bamford, who started doing comedy in Minneapolis. And I wasn't alone. Everyone, I think, who saw her realized what a unique and great talent she was. But I was very encouraging to her as well.
See, that's so cool. That's I think that's one thing. I think when you're in a smaller town, I think it's like that community sense. In Philly, we had that tight knit of guys like Chris and Paul, and we had two guys, John Matta, who's a dear
great
friend,
guy.
And these people that we knew, and you don't see him for years. And then, Chris, I saw him, he's been on the show twice. I didn't see him for like 20 years. I'm like, still looks the same, just a little bit heavier.
Yeah, right.
And Matta is still the same, but a little heavier.
Yeah.
Tompkins looks better than he did back then.
Yeah, he lost
weight. I was like, what the hell happened, Paul? I said, you look a lot different. You look much better.
Mm-hmm.
But so you're doing it in Minnesota, and now are you getting work a lot, or are you going to get on the road?
Yeah,
right
away. The thing was, is my standard of living was so low that once I started making any money from stand-up comedy, I pretty much was a professional comedian. But I'm making like $5,000, $6,000 a year or something,
Right.
But I live very cheaply. And what happened was I was doing every open mic in Minneapolis. And then at one open mic, Liz Winstead came down, who went on to co-create The Daily Show, and she saw me and she said, "Oh, wow, you're funny. Why, you want to be in my show this weekend?" She was headlining at the Comedy Gallery that weekend, and she said, "I'd love you to come and MC my show." And so I went down. I think her engagement, the open mic was on a Monday or Tuesday, and her engagement started on a Wednesday. And I went down, and I was really, it's a good thing to think about in terms of fear and stuff, because I was so frightened about doing this real thing. And if any excuse, if it had fallen through and I didn't have to go, I would have been relieved. But I went, and Scott Hansen, who ran the Comedy Gallery, was there, and he didn't know anything about that Liz said that I could. So there was a little bit of a, you know, I, Liz doesn't book the show, you know. You know, he was a little surly about it, but he let me be in the show. And then from that night on, every night, just about every night at the Comedy Gallery, I emceed the show, I tore tickets, I sat people, and I got a ton of stage time.
Isn't that funny? That's right.
Thanks to Liz Winstead and also Scott Hansen, who let me be in the
show.
That's
funny you said you worked at the club, because I used to do it at the Comedy Factory out in Philly.
Uh-huh.
And there's a few of us. And actually, one of the people who worked there, which people were like, wow, was Adam McKay, actually.
A
little bit.
Sure.
But we did it because back then, you get paid $5 under the table.
Uh-huh.
And you get to see great comics. But it meant on the open mic that you got a slotted position.
Right,
so we're
right.
like, well, instead of drawing, because it'd be worse when you go into the club, you draw it out of the hat. One week you get four, you're like, yeah. Next week you get 26.
Yeah.
And you're going, oh, great. And you're not going anywhere because I drove over the bridge from New Jersey
right,
to Philly.
Right.
It's not like you're going anywhere, so you're just stuck. And then like some acts are just so awful, and they kept showing up. And then there's some acts that were great, and you'd be like, oh, my God, this person. So, okay, so you're doing it in Minnesota. Now you're starting to perform. You're starting to perform a lot.
Yeah, I'm up pretty much every night for years from then on.
Now, are you still writing? Did you do some side writing, or
yeah? Well, I wrote. You know, I was writing for my act, and then I was also writing screenplays that never went anywhere. I know that's so unusual, but
I know.
So I was. You know, I just had ambitions to write on a show or to. Was probably going to move to LA eventually. I guess that's, you know, the standard plan. But, and I was making a living, a meager living, in Minneapolis and doing one-nighters around the Midwest, Iowa, Wisconsin, Nebraska, North and South Dakota. And then out of the blue, I was friends with all the people who ended up doing Mystery Science Theater 3000, Joel Hodgson. Mike Nelson was a really good friend of mine.
Were they from Minnesota?
Yeah, they were all. Mike Nelson, I pretty much saw his first open mic in L.A., and I was running that open mic, and I was very encouraging him. I always gave him good slots and stuff, And I knew Trace Beaulieu was hilarious. And so I knew all these people. And in the second season of... And they did Mystery Science Theater in Minneapolis. So
okay, so it was shot there?
Yeah,
or?
It was shot there.
No, but you had moved out to L.A. yet?
Yeah. Oh, no. I hadn't moved to L.A. I was still in Minneapolis. And I wasn't ready to do that yet either as a comedian, or I didn't have the financial resources to do it. And... But I was friends with all these guys who ended up doing this public access, UHF station show.
Didn't you love UHF?
Yeah,
I miss UHF.
We
had 17, 29, and 48.
Yeah.
And it was great because it was in that second band, and you'd click it, and it's like, there's only certain numbers in that band.
Yeah.
And it's like, it was so weird. It's like people now, I always say people now, they have no clue like what TV was like.
Right,
just an antenna or like.
It was all much simpler back
then.
Yeah,
we had eight channels.
Yeah.
That was it. And it was like, no one really counted PBS. Channel 12 as a channel because you were a kid. You only thought it was like 3, 6, and 10.
Yeah.
But now it's like, I go through my cable, and I had a problem with my cable upstairs, and my guy's like, well, you know, you have a bunch of HD stations on below 700. I'm like, why doesn't the cable company tell me that? It's like they add this stuff. I don't get charged for it, but it's like he was checking it out. I had like all like 40 HD stations. You think they tell you?
Yeah.
It pisses me off. So, okay, so.
So I met them, and then this opening came up for a writer on Mystery Science Theater.
Now, it was shot in
Minneapolis.
It was on
and
UHF
I was there.
Channel.
I was just a middle act comedian, but I was friends with all them. And as soon as this opening came up, I was the first guy they thought of because they thought I was funny. And they also knew that I was a film buff. So I knew a lot about movies and popular culture, which was also kind of an element that you had to know to work on that show. And they hired me to write on it. And then they just made me a cast member, too. So it was all just pure luck and fortune.
That was taking place in Minneapolis.
In Minneapolis, yeah.
We're going to take a break. We're going to come back and talk about that. Do you have a website?
I have a Twitter.
Okay, Twitter. What's your Twitter?
It's Twitter at Frank Conniff or / Frank Conniff.
Okay, follow him.
And also Facebook I'm on, too.
So follow him. I'm Twitter.
Facebook. And cinematictitanic.com is a place where you can get all the information about the Cinematic Titanic shows.
Okay, cool. Well, check that out, people. And I'm at Cooper Talk. Send me an email at cooper@indy100.com. We'll be right back talking about mystery. So it's so funny. Like, a lot of the younger people, they still know that. It's like, it's held up. It's like through video.
Oh,
stuff.
Yeah.
People, it's weird because...
That's why we're doing live shows now, because it's still popular.
We're going to come back and talk about that. I'm here with Frank Conniff. Remember, I'm Steve Cooper. I'm only as hip as my guests. We'll be right back. This always happens, Frank. My ads never start.
It's like flying high-priced hookers to your hotel room from New York.
Taking it slowly into my hot, wet...
Okay, maybe not. But it is cheaper. Cooper Talk.
Cooper Talk.
Looking for great deals on apparel? Visit OnlineSalesMart.com. Currently, we have authentic Armani designer sunglasses at $100 or more off original price. Novelty neckties of all types for under $10. Necktie sets at discounted prices. And high-quality and genuine leather dress shoes, wallets, handbags, briefcases, and more for less. Visit www.OnlineSalesMart.com. All major credit cards are accepted and all orders are shipped on the double. Once again, that's OnlineSalesMart.com.
Remember abundance. At Shakey's Pizza, don't cut back.
Cut loose with our all-you-can-eat bunch of lunch. Now just $6.99.
Less belt tightening.
More belt loosening.
Shakey's all-you-can-eat bunch of lunch. Now just $6.99.
With Supershopper.org, you can post your ad online in just 60 seconds. That's fast. That means that old junk sitting in your garage can be online in less time than it takes for you to stub your toe while looking for the light switch. List your electronics, furniture, automotive, garage sales, and more. If you can legally buy it and sell it, it's on. Supershopper.org. Job postings just $25. Everything else, free. That means you can post your resume, get a job, find an apartment, furnish it, sell your car, buy an SUV, adopt a pet, find a house, get a mortgage, find a handyman, sell the house, buy a beach house, buy a surfboard. Supershopper.org. Now you get it.
Would you like to find out how you can easily own gold and silver bullion? With oil prices and food costs skyrocketing, there's one sure way to hedge against inflation: owning precious metals. And we can show you how. Operators are standing by with your investor's kit on buying precious metals. Call 1-877-722-7032 to learn the secrets of protecting your net worth. Call now to learn how to hedge yourself with precious metals. We'll show you how to finance and own large amounts of precious metals with small amounts of money. This is not options or futures. We'll show you how to collateralize hundreds of thousands of dollars in precious metals with as little as a 25% investment. For an investor's kit with charts and graphs on the latest precious metals trends and opportunities, call 877-722-7032. That's 877-722-7032. To find out how you can own gold and silver and profit from the wild swings in today's economy. As with all speculative investments, purchasing precious metals involves a risk of loss and should be carefully evaluated prior to investing.
Indy100.com. Welcome back to Cooper Talk. I'm your host, Steve Cooper. And remember, I'm only as hip as my guest. And I was just talking to Frank about my, the symptoms, because people know I had a health problem, the congestive heart failure, which I always say they call it that because just to scare the crap out of you. Right. But no, I never knew the difference in between tired and exhausted. Uh-huh. And I was just exhausted. It felt like a cold at first. Mm-hmm. And I noticed that my ankles swell. Mm-hmm. And your body swells because the stuff builds up.
Right.
You know what I mean? So fluids build up. Mm-hmm. And so that was it. And I remember going out of route, so I could barely push the cart, and going upstairs was awful. Mm-hmm. And that was exhausted. I mean, tired is when you're like, oh, yeah, I want to go to sleep. Exhausted, you're like, and I couldn't sleep at night. And so, yeah, but that was it. But it's now I'm eating healthy, people. It's very good to eat healthy.
Yeah, that's what I've heard.
And I love to drink, but I don't anymore. I mean, basically at one time, I can have a glass of wine here and then. But at one time, in like a month and a half ago, I gave up alcohol, cigarettes, caffeine.
Wow.
And fast food. And I'm going to tell you something. I don't miss the drinking. I miss the fast food.
Yeah, I bet.
Oh, God. When I was back east and you see those little pizza, and the pizza's so good, or like a cheesesteak and right near Philly, and you're walking by.
I had the Philly, what's this, Ron's or whatever?
Geno's or Pat's.
Pat's.
Yeah.
I went to Pat's. I've never had anything as good.
Oh,
as
my
that.
God. And I sit yeah. there, and now whenever I shop, I have to. I look on the internet for the sodium. I did find out I can make my own cheesesteaks if I use Steakums, which are a cheap substitute, but I might get a bread maker, too, because then I can control it. And then I can go, okay, I can make a cheesesteak. But anyway, that was just a weekend off thing. But that's just, yeah. So if you're feeling light, heavy-chested, go to the doctor.
Okay, I will.
Take it in advance, because it's very easy to take care of, and you don't want to wait too long. Remember that, people, if you have medical problems, wait to go to the doctor. And check out Dr. Dan's blog. That's my cardiologist. Very insightful. They're starting a show in Minnesota.
Right.
And you're writing for it.
Well, they had started it already. They had done it as a local UHF show for a year. And then they did it for 13 episodes on the Comedy Channel, which became Comedy Central soon after that.
Isn't it weird when that came out? It was so.
Because it came out, the Hot Channel came out at the same time, and the Comedy Channel and the Hot Channel merged and became Comedy Central.
And so, back then, the Comedy Channel, I forgot that it was called that. That's funny. It had a following, but not a huge following at the time, right?
Well,
I think the
problem was they weren't on in a lot of play. And in fact, when I was first on Mystery Science Theater, it wasn't on in New York for the longest time. It wasn't on in Minneapolis. We had a party when our first episode premiered, the first episode of my season premiered. We went to someone's house who had Comedy Central.
Okay.
You know, it was hard to find. It wasn't in a lot of places, so that was the struggle. But I think once they merged with the Hot Channel, then they were able to get a much more coverage. But
well, explain to the listeners what Mystery Science Theater 3000 was all about.
Well, it was created by Joel Hodgson, and the premise was a guy is trapped in outer space with two robot buddies, is subjected to experiments by this evil mad scientist who's back down on Earth, who wants to study how people react in stressful situations or whatever. So he shows them really bad movies.
Okay.
And so to kind of make it through the movies, Joel and his robots, make sarcastic remarks and use comedy as a way to survive the experience. And that was the basic premise of it.
That must have been a fun, fun writing thing.
Yeah, it was. It was really fun. It was because I've said this before, but when I was a kid and I was watching a lot of TV, my mom said, Frank, you're never going to get a job watching TV. And then it turned out I did get a job
That's funny.
When I was on Mystery Science Theater, because I was paid to sit in a room with a bunch of people and watch a movie all day.
So what was the process? You'd watch the movie once and people would write stuff down, then you would
We'd all yell out comments and one person would type it all with a time code.
Okay.
So we would know where to come. And so then after we did that for a couple of days, we would split up, and some of us, myself included, our job was to take this section of the script and go through all the comments and then decide, you know, like one moment might have three jokes or five jokes, and maybe two of them are really funny, and then you decide which one am I going to keep, and then which character would be best to say that joke. And so you'd assign the lines to either Joel or later Mike, and Tom Servo or Crow T-Robot, you'd assign the lines to them, and so that was kind of how the script was. And then we'd rehearse it and make more changes and tape it, make more changes. So it was a constantly evolving process of writing and rewriting.
Now, it started getting a really big cult following, right?
I mean, yeah, it did pretty much right from the start. It had a very loyal fan base from before I was there, from when they did it on the UHF channel. They left a message. They left a number for people to leave messages, and the message thing was fulled up, and they got a lot of mail of people who really liked the show.
So when it got picked up in comedy by Comedy Channel, it was still being shot in.
Yes.
Okay. Now, did it shoot there the whole time? Or
The whole time. It shot in Minneapolis, yes.
Now, did you stay living in Minneapolis the whole time?
Well, I was there for five seasons, And in 95, I just decided I had done 109 episodes of Mystery Science Theater, and I was, and as great as that was, I was just felt I was ready to try new stuff, and so I moved to LA to seek my fortune there.
Now, were you still doing stand-up when you were writing a show, or had you pulled back?
Yeah, I still was doing it, although I pulled back a little bit. I remember there was one time we, that day at Mystery Science Theater, the Washington Post, Tom Shales, this TV critic, had written this incredible rave review about the show and singled each of us out individually for how brilliant we were.
Okay.
And then that night I went and I did a hell gig, you know, and I was like, you know, I mean, which is, I guess it's good to be humbled like that, but it kind of made me feel at the time like this one thing, doing stand up, is just not giving back to me the way I would like it to. And then this other thing I'm doing is making an impact in the entertainment world, and people are responding positive to it. So I still continue to do stand-up, but I wasn't as relentless about it. And actually, when I moved to L.A., my plan, because like I said, my ambition was always to be a TV comedy writer, which I was on Mystery Science Theater. But when I came to L.A., you know, I wanted to write on different shows. And my thought was, I'm going to focus on that. I'm not going to do stand-up comedy anymore. I kind of felt like I had, in my mind, I had resigned from stand-up comedy. But when I came to L.A., I came smack dab in the middle of this great comedy scene that was going. What we were just talking about alternative comedy in you know, bookstores and coffee shops and art galleries and who knows where else. And there were all these great comedians performing, doing new, exciting things. And because I was on Mystery Science Theater, I was kind of invited into that world. And so I actually, when I came to L.A., that's when I really started doing stand-up comedy a lot again. I kind of rejuvenated that, and I've been doing it ever since, never really making a living as a stand-up comic in all these years, always making a living as a TV comedy writer, but I've stayed devoted to performing stand-up because I love doing it, and I love doing it in LA.
Right. Now, so when you came out, did you have some juice around you because you were writing for that show? Or I mean, did people sit there?
I thought I might, but you know what, I really didn't. It opened some doors for me. But my first year was pretty bleak. It was kind of a big slap in the face. It was just, you know, I wasn't getting any work, and I was running out of the – I didn't save a lot of money. I saved some money, but it wasn't a lot. So I kind of planned the thing not very well. I should have saved more money, so I would have had less stress. But it was very stressful that first year. But that was also that first year, though – you know, when I look back at it, it all makes sense to me, because that's one of the reasons I was going out and doing stand-up so much is, you know, I wasn't in demand writing for TV shows or anything. Nobody was hiring me to do what I came out to do. So I started having a lot of fun. And I know that first year in L.A., I know it was very stressful, but I also look back on it. I had so many great, fun times just going out and performing. So, but then, you know, after a year, I started to get work and things started to come together. But it took me a while, you know.
So
it didn't just happen. Oh, look, the guy from Mystery Science Theater is here. He has heat on him. Let's all meet with him. You know, didn't really happen that way.
So you wrote for Sabrina the Teenage Witch.
Right.
Now, how was that? Were you the cat?
No, Nick Bakay was the cat.
I thought someone said you were the voice of the cat.
No, I wasn't. Nick Bakay, who was brilliant, who's a great writer and a hilarious performer, he was the cat. But, I started on – it was a great experience working on Sabrina, because it was very different from Mystery Science Theater, because it was like, okay, this is primetime TV now. This is the mainstream. And – It was a really great thing when I went in my first day there, and I was really nervous and was sitting around the table with the other writers. And then I started pitching jokes that were scoring and that got into the script. And then I realized, hey, wow, I could do this. Because Mystery Science Theater really, in many ways, it was a TV show, but working on it really felt more like being in a band, kind of.
Okay.
You know, but when I realized in L.A. that I could make a living writing for television shows, that was a great feeling. It felt like more like this is my profession now. You know what I
right.
mean? So it was just fun to work on it. And, you know, most of the shows I've worked on, I enjoy the even some of the shows are better than others, but I always enjoy the process of writing on a TV show. It's an enjoyable thing.
Was the structure a lot different for Sabrina?
Yeah, because the big difference is that you're trying to develop stories, and coming up with stories is much harder than writing jokes. At least for me, jokes come very
jokes
easily.
Are right there. A story actually has to have an arc and go for a while. It's not like, okay, a joke, you can throw out a few jokes in a conversation.
But so coming up with the story is the and in Mystery Science Theater, the movie provided us with the story.
Right. You know? Exactly. So,
provided, even as bad as it was, it provided us with a narrative. So that what was different about writing on TV for like sitcoms and so it's a really fun process, but it can be very hard because it's hard to develop story. Everyone, either best writers, all have a difficult time breaking a story. You know, it doesn't come easily.
How long did you write for Sabrina?
I was there 4 seasons.
Okay. And then so where did you go after that?
After that, I was the head writer for an animated show called Invader Zim, which is another show with a big cult following. It was on Nickelodeon for 1 year. It was created and run by this brilliant guy, Jonan Vasquez, and it was a really great show, although I can't take a lot of credit for how great it was, because it was mainly Jonan and the incredible staff of artists and animators and designers that they had there. It's an amazing looking show and has a very funny sensibility to it, which is really Jonan's sensibility. That is great. And I did that, and I wrote on the Drew Carey show. And
what was it like for you? I mean, okay, you go from Mystery Science to Sabrina to the Zim to Drew Carey. I mean, it's all across the board.
I have a very eclectic career.
Did you find some of that challenging when you sat there and went, wait a second? Because I'm sure you get in a certain, and I'm sure after a while, you know, you get into a rhythm.
Right, right.
And then all of a sudden you're going from writing about a witch and kids to a Zim.
Yeah.
I mean, just does it
throw you off? It's always a different process on each show. Every show has different needs. And but that's the fun of it, you know. And then I went from Drew Carey and Invader Zim, and then I worked on another show that's one of my all-time favorite shows that I worked on with my friend Liz Winstead and Brian Unger. It was a show on the Oxygen Network called O to B, and it did for like daytime talk shows what The Daily Show did for news shows. It was a satire on, you know, Martha Stewart and all those kind of shows. And I was I played the part of the Gelman like producer on the show, and it was a really funny show. But we only did 6 episodes for it. And
did it air?
It aired, yeah. It aired, and it got great reviews. But I think cable was going in a different direction from satiric comedy. You know, now like the Oxygen Network, the Bravo Network, E, all of those channels have all kind of gone in the direction of reality shows.
Yeah, and it's all crap. I was flipping around. There's a show called Big Ang or Big Ang. And I'm sitting there, and I'm going, what the? And I guess it was one of the Mob Wives. I had to post something on Facebook.
I've never watched any of those
shows.
And
I haven't either, but I'm sitting there, and I'm going, I watched it for like 10 minutes to see, wait a second, why is this? Because she talked like Harvey Fierstein. And she looked like a transvestite. And I'm thinking, is this a real show? And it's like, I put it on Facebook. I go, what the? And someone I went to high school was like, oh, yeah, she gave me the whole insight. And I'm like, what's going on with this crap? I mean, you sit there and you look at it and you go, just the titles. I'm like, and then they keep redoing it, like Teen Mom, and there's like 18 moms.
Yeah.
And it's like, what the hell is going on?
Yeah, they're encouraging teen pregnancies.
I know, exactly. That's what you're doing back when I was in high school. You know, the girls didn't want to put it. Now they want to get to it because they can get on a damn show.
Right.
So you write for the show. Now, were you bummed when the show got canceled? Because
I was. But as I've said to Liz since then, I was kind of in. I didn't realize what an awful thing it was that it got canceled, because at the time I was like, oh, but you know, I'm sure there'll be other funny shows, or we'll do something else. But that was it was six episodes, and it was a great experience, and it's just a shame that it didn't go for 5 years.
Yeah, I mean, it's so weird. That we're gonna take a break. I'll give your Twitter again.
Twitter/FrankConniff.
Just hit him up. I'm at Cooper Talk. Also send me an email, cooper@indy100.com. We'll be right back with Frank Conniff.
I guess the worst part of all this is that the fools who run this show broadcast this crap all over the world. Cooper Talk.
Would you like to find out how you can easily own gold and silver bullion? With oil prices and food costs skyrocketing, there's one sure way to hedge against inflation: owning precious metals. And we can show you how. Operators are standing by with your investor's kit on buying precious metals. Call 1-877-722-7032 to learn the secrets of protecting your net worth. Call now to learn how to hedge yourself with precious metals. We'll show you how to finance and own large amounts of precious metals with small amounts of money. This is not options or futures. We'll show you how to collateralize hundreds of thousands of dollars in precious metals with as little as a 25% investment. For an investor's kit with charts and graphs on the latest precious metals trends and opportunities, call 877-722-7032. That's 877-722-7032. To find out how you can own gold and silver and profit from the wild swings in today's economy. As with all speculative investments, purchasing precious metals involves a risk of loss and should be carefully evaluated prior to investing.
With supershopper.org, you can post your ad online in just 60 seconds. That's fast. That means that old junk sitting in your garage can be online in less time than it takes for you to stub your toe while looking for the light switch. List your electronics, furniture, automotive, garage sales, and more. If you can legally buy it and sell it, it's on. Supershopper.org. Job postings just $25. Everything else free. That means you can post your resume, get a job, find an apartment, furnish it, sell your car, buy an SUV, adopt a pet, find a house, get a mortgage, find a handyman, sell the house, buy a beach house, buy a surfboard. Supershopper.org. Now you get it.
Looking for great deals on apparel? Visit OnlineSalesMart.com. Currently, we have authentic Armani designer sunglasses at $100 or more off original price. Novelty neckties of all types for under $10. Necktie sets at discounted prices. And high-quality and genuine leather dress shoes, wallets, handbags, briefcases, and more for less. Visit www.OnlineSalesMart.com. All major credit cards are accepted, and all orders are shipped on the double. Once again, that's OnlineSalesMart.com.
At Shakey's Pizza, don't cut back.
Cut loose with our all-you-can-eat bunch of lunch. Now just $6.99.
Less belt tightening.
More belt loosening. Shakey's all-you-can-eat bunch of lunch. Now just $6.99.
Indy100.com.
Welcome back to Cooper Talk. I'm your host, Steve Cooper. And remember, I'm only as hip as my guest. And hopefully my voice will come back soon. I don't like talking like this. It's very scratchy. I don't like it. I feel like I was talking to Frank about the Big Ange, the reality show. I feel like that lady. She talks like a dude. It's crazy. So the show went, and you were bummed out. Now, where did you go after that?
Well, after that, I worked on what was called the New Tom Green Show on MTV, which was Tom Green's attempt at a late night talk show, and that was, once again, that was short lived and really. I wasn't as passionate about it as I was about O to B, the Liz Winstead thing.
Right.
It was a fun experience. He was a good guy to work with. The other writers were great. And so that ended. And then I moved to New York because Liz Winstead, once again, hired me because she was the creative director of Air America Radio. And
okay.
at the time, they wanted Air America Radio was going to be the big progressive anecdote to Rush Limbaugh and all that stuff. And they hired Al Franken and Janine Garofalo and Sam Cedar and Mark Maron. And it had this pretty spectacular lineup, Randy Rhodes and Rachel Maddow was, that's where she was discovered, was there. But that didn't work out. The financing was all screwed up. The people running it were all, didn't have their stuff together. But I did that for a year and a half, and so I moved back to New York, which I was very excited to do. And I think we did a lot of really good stuff there, but it was ultimately, it was a disappointing experience.
Now, that was that the first time you lived in New York professionally? Like, since
yeah, it's
writing?
The first time I came back to New York for a job, yeah.
Okay, that must have been good. It must have been
yeah,
good.
I was very excited to be back. But when I was there, I did miss L.A. a lot, which surprised me, but I really did.
So and, you're there. And then the show doesn't work. So then what do you do now? Do you sit down and come back to L.A.?
Yeah, I was anxious to come back to L.A. anyway because I wasn't that happy there. But, yeah, I came back to L.A. And actually when I was in New York, I also wrote a pilot for the Bravo network that never aired. And then I came back to L.A. and I wrote another. I wrote an animated pilot for Nickelodeon called Akihabara at Deep, which was like a Japanese anime thing.
Okay.
That would have been a great show. Once again, didn't get picked up. And and then since then, I've mainly been doing Cinematic Titanic, the live show, and I started doing a show at the Steve Allen Theater called Cartoon Dump, which is a parody of kids' shows.
Now, what is that? Is it a sketch show? Or?
Yeah, it's once a month, the fourth Monday of every month, and next Monday will be the next one. We do a show that's kind of a parody of the cheap local kid shows I grew up on, where I play a character, Moodsy, the clinically depressed owl, and we show actual cartoons that my friend Jerry Beck, who is a noted animation historian, has in his collection, these horrible, horrible cartoons
okay.
from the 60s and 70s. And we show them, and then we do sketches and songs and things between. And we have stand-up comedians performing it, too. We've had almost every great stand-up comic in L.A. in the show.
How's the turnout been?
It's good. We get a very consistent audience for it.
And is it, what time is it at?
It's 8 o'clock next Monday at the Steve Allen Theater.
Okay.
So you can check that out on the on my Facebook page. There'll be announcements about that.
So now the Cinematic Titanic, that is the live version?
Yeah, that's the live version of Mystery Science Theater. It's Joel Hodgson, who created it, Trace Beaulieu, and J. Elvis Weinstein, who were from the original cast and helped develop it. And myself and Mary Jo Peel, we were also both subsequently writers and cast members on the show. And we basically do what we did on Mystery Science Theater, except without the robot characters. It's just us. We show a really bad movie. We have about 12 or 13 in our repertoire right now. And we show a movie and we do commentary on it, just like on Mystery Science Theater, except that it's without the robots, and it's also a live thing, which Mystery Science Theater wasn't, and that's what makes it really fun, doing it live in front of an audience.
It's not scripted.
Like, it is scripted, okay. Yes. It's very, just like Mystery Science Theater, it's very tightly scripted, although we do end up ad-libbing during the show. We end up just being loose and having fun with certain moments, but it's, you know, we spend several months writing and refining the script before we do the show.
Now, how do you choose the movies from that 12? Which night you're going to do what?
Well, it kind of depends. Lately, like, we've done a few markets several times. Like, we've done San Francisco a few times. We've done Milwaukee. We do Milwaukee every year, or we'll have done Chicago, too. So we had been kind of around that market. So if we did a movie recently, or in that same area, we'll do a different movie. And if we do two shows in a town, it's always two separate movies. So you get to, it's always a different show if when you come to see us.
So how's the response been to it?
The response has been phenomenal.
Now, have you noticed the demographics? Is it older people or like people that
It's people
watching?
Who people who grew up on the show, some older people who grew up on the show who watched it when it was first on, but a lot of them have kids that they bring who they turned on in the show. And then there's a lot of younger people who've discovered the show through, who never watched it when it was first on, but who discovered it on the internet and by the Shout Factory DVD collected. And now it's Cinematic Titanic is on Hulu now, so people can watch it that way. So there's an incredible mix of people coming to the show, old, young, sometimes very young, sometimes little kids, you know.
How did you get the name Cinematic Titanic?
That was Joel came up with the name, and I think it was just, he just thought of it. It sounded catchy, and it evoked movies and disaster, movies being disasters, which...
Right.
All the movies we do are pretty disastrously bad. So Joel came up with it.
When was the first time you took it on the road? I mean, did Joel come to you guys and say, "Hey, I want to"?
Well, at first the main thing was we were just going to make DVDs and put them out ourselves.
Okay.
And our first DVDs were all done in the studio, and we hadn't thought much about doing it live. But actually, our very first live gig was at Industrial Light and Magic, or Lucasfilm, up in San Francisco.
Okay.
They had contacted us and wanted us to come up and do a private show. And we did a show there, and it was really fun, and it went great. And then we hooked up with people who could book us for live shows, and so we've been doing that ever since.
Do you actually go into a regular movie theater? Or
no, we usually perform in... regular theaters, usually we draw usually about 1,200 people.
Okay, and then,
so that kind of size theater is what we
usually
do.
And they put the screen up, and then the
yeah.
Now, are you guys sitting in the front row, or are you sitting?
No,
on stage?
No, we're sitting on stage, like kind of to the side of the screen.
I guess you're watching a movie.
We're watching the movie.
Now, do you like doing that? I mean, did you have fun? Is it fun to get back
it.
With the girl group?
I really love. Doing Cinematic Titanic live is just about my favorite thing I've ever done.
Really?
In my career. And also I get to do stand-up before we do the movie. So yeah, it's just a great... The audiences are so great, and it's you know, it's just been an incredible experience doing it.
How long... Okay, so you're sitting there, and you know you're going to do, let's say, a show in... You said Ann Arbor.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so you're going to do a show in Ann Arbor, and... You decide what movie you're going to do.
Right.
Now, is it all, I mean, once do you all constantly get new, you said you have 11 or 12 movies.
Right.
That are already scripted, I guess.
Yes.
Now, do you constantly add new movies, or do you sit there and go, okay, you know, we're going to do this?
Yeah, we do, you know, there's a lot of movies we've done several times, but for instance, in Ann Arbor, we just premiered, we did the premiere of a brand new movie that we, first time ever doing it, that we just wrote called The Doll Squad. And that went over really well. But in our other, we did two shows. And in the other show, we did another movie called Rattlers, which is one of our more recent ones. But we've done it several times. We tend to do live, I think, the more recent films. But sometimes we leave it up to the audience. The promoter, like, has a vote online or something, and then they vote which movie they want us to do.
How do you find these crappy movies? I mean, whose job is that? I mean,
Joel, it used to be my job on Mystery Science Theater, but it's Joel, I have to say, has kind of taken the lead on that with Cinematic Titanic. He seems to, you know, these films are available. They have distributors, and you have to, you know, call up and get the rights to show them. And it's usually not that expensive, but you have to pay. And even when it's a public domain film, you have to pay for the print. And one thing Joel has said, he'd be able to speak better about this, but he says a lot of times he'll see a movie and he thinks, oh, that'll be really good for us to do. But sometimes it's really hard to find a a usable print of the movie.
So you actually
finding a print is a big part of it.
How do you do? I mean, what do you go on like Craigslist going, I'm looking for a print of Killer Frogs from Bermuda or what?
No, it's with the distributor, you know, and they have whatever the print is. And sometimes they're usable, sometimes they're not. And sometimes now they can, we can make the prints better with technology, but don't ask me about that because I don't know anything.
Now, when
about
you
it.
Did it, when you found the movies, what would you do? Just go online? Or
no,
it wasn't even online back then. So
no.
Like, how would you find it? Would you sit there and go, I saw this really crappy
Comedy
movie?
Comedy Central would send us, they would go to distributors like Sinister Cinema.
Okay.
And there's a few of them, and send me VHS tapes of movie, like a whole box or two boxes of VHS tapes. And I would just, one day it was my job to just sit and watch them and go through them. And I could usually tell 5 minutes, 10 minutes into a movie if it was going to, if it was going to be suitable or not. Or in other words, the ones that weren't suitable, I could tell after 10 minutes.
So I didn't
have to watch the whole things. But then you'd see something like Manos, the Hands of Fate or something like that. And you'd go, oh, wow, this is really interesting. This could be really funny, and then you watch the whole thing, and then I would show it to the rest of the group, and they would sign off on it, and then we, if we could get the rights, in most cases we could, some cases we couldn't get the rights to things, then we do the movie.
What was it like when you actually saw a good movie after watching all that crap? Were you just like, oh my God? Like, I mean,
yeah, it was actually kind of. I remember one time when I was at Mystery Science Theater watching that night, I went home and The Best Years of Our Lives was on Turner Classic Movies. And I remember it was just such a joyful thing to watch a great movie.
Okay, you must
and
feel
plus
like
it was like it's like a 3-hour movie, but yet it doesn't seem that way.
Right.
Whereas on Mystery Science Theater, we were watching 80-minute movies that seemed like they were 10 hours.
Right, right. God,
know?
It's like, oh, God.
Yeah.
But at least you're still liking movies. So now you said you're coming to L.A. to perform? Or?
Well, this isn't official yet. This is breaking news.
Breaking news,
I'm
people.
Breaking,
breaking news.
It looks like we're going to be performing at the Saban Theater in Los Angeles on August 18th as part of the CineFamily Film Festival.
Now, what's that?
That CineFamily is what used to be the Silent Movie Theater.
Okay.
And they have a lot of great film programs there.
It's right on Fairfax.
Yes, yes. And they're having a film festival, I guess, and we're going to be a part of it. But it hasn't been officially announced yet. Maybe it'll all fall apart. So I'm just saying it's very likely that that's going to happen. And August 18th at the Saban Theater.
Now, if it happens, do you know what movie you're going to do already?
I think there's a very good chance we're going to do our latest movie, The Doll Squad. That seems to be what we're talking about.
Now, can I find these movies on, like, Netflix and stuff?
Some of them, yeah, I think you can, actually.
No.
The Doll Squad is made by Ted V. Mickles, who's a very well-known exploitation filmmaker who has a whole following of his own. He's actually a Facebook friend of mine.
Oh, that's cool.
So.
So now, right. Now can they? Where can they find past DVDs of Mystery Science Theater? Is there DVDs out there?
Oh yeah, Shout Factory puts them out. You can go to Amazon.
Okay.
They're in most stores. The few DVD stores that are left.
Isn't that weird? There. It's like God. It's like
they're
places.
There, and you can, and also as I said before, you can find Cinematic Titanic episodes on Hulu. So,
okay.
And you can watch them for free there.
And now you have another bait. So that's the live show?
Some of them are the live show. Some of them are a studio. But it's the movies that we do live.
Okay. So now Cinematic, that's the website you said, Cinematic?
CinematicTitanic.com.
And what can they find there?
You can buy DVDs there. You can find out information about our upcoming shows.
Any other shows coming up besides possible LA one?
We're doing a place we've done a few times already called the Family Arena in St. Charles. St. Louis, Michigan. St. Louis, Missouri, right?
Yeah.
It's outside of St. Louis, so I got my geography
That's
mixed
right.
up there a minute. I wouldn't have that would have been bad if this were Jeopardy, but
exactly.
So we're doing that in November. I don't know the exact date, but it's in November. And we have a couple other gigs that are in the works that I can't announce yet that are probably going to
happen. And they can find that on the website.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I want to thank you, Frank. Give them your Twitter and Facebook info again.
Oh, you can find me, Frank Conniff, on Twitter, Frank Conniff on Facebook. And also, I forgot to mention, I have a YouTube channel now.
Okay.
And I make little videos at home. I have about almost 25 of them up now, and just go to look for Frank Conniff on YouTube.
And that's C-O-N-I-F-F.
C-O-N-N-I-F-F.
Oh, C-O-N-N-I-F-F. Wait.
Two N's, two F's.
Okay, I see. I was wrong.
C-O-N-N-I-F-F.
Anyway, thank you so much for coming
on, Frank. Thank you for having me.
It was a pleasure to have you on.
Great to be here.
It was great. People, remember, hit me up at Cooper Talk at Twitter. Follow me, or Facebook at Cooper Talk. Also, email me at Cooper Indie100.com. You can find past episodes at coopertalk.podbean.com. I'll be uploading a bunch of past episodes. Or just go to iTunes and type in Cooper Talk, one word, and in the search box, and you'll find some past episodes. And I want to thank you guys for listening. Have a wonderful weekend. We have some great guests coming up in the next few weeks. Remember, I'm Steve Cooper. I'm only as hip as my guests, and you guys have a great